Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Tuesday, October 14th, Joe was joined by The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, Mayor of the City of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, and former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain.
Donald Trump said yesterday while in the Middle East that it was a new Middle East, is what he said during his speech. He landed in Israel Monday morning, minutes after the first of 20 hostages were released by Hamas, and spent the day basking in the applause of a country that credits him more than Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for joyous family reunions and a ceasefire after 2 years of war. Mr. Trump seized on the moment to tell the Knesset, Israel's parliament, that this is, quote, not only the end of a war, this is the end of the age of terror and death, using a line that other presidents have reached for and often been disappointed. He added, this is the historic dawn of a new Middle East. He then traveled to Egypt, where dozens of world leaders awaited his arrival for a quote-unquote peace summit that offered the pomp and circumstance that Mr. Trump is known to enjoy. Banners adorned with his face were dotted along the streets of a Red Sea resort. From the cities, the will of the people of meets the resolve of the world leaders to end the war in Gaza, said the president of Egypt. They all carry a single message to mankind: enough war, welcome to peace. Now the question, at the summit, neither Israel nor Hamas were participants, and although the White House released what appeared to be a document signed by the countries that did attend, it did not commit the signatories to any specific action. Rarely has an American president, particularly one as divisive as at home as Mr. Trump is, been met with such adulation abroad in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv. Tens of thousands yelled, Trump, 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 and the Knesset some members wore red MAGA-style hats. All of this comes at the point when, meanwhile, Mr. Netanyahu, whose name was booed at the same square, declared the president the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the White House. And, of course, more talk of nominating for the Nobel Peace Prize and the Israel Prize. And all of this to say, we still don't know what's going to happen next. And there is a lot of the hostage release and the turnover was certainly something that that was being worked on for a long time, and you can't take that away from the president and for all those who work so hard on it. But where we go from here is still a huge question mark, and one that I think we'll see over time as to how it plays out. So as we look at those facts, who would like to start us off? Mayor, you want to?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I think everyone is breathing a huge sigh of relief that the fighting in Gaza has stopped, and are hopeful that the hundreds of truckloads of aid that are desperately needed reach the Palestinians in Gaza, and that the rebuilding is able to begin, and that this is truly an end to the violence there. The next phase and the next stage of this is what comes next. And, you know, look, I think that, you know, to the extent that Trump can claim credit for this, it is a good thing that the violence has ended. But we also have a president who has serially underrated the complexity of most situations that he has faced, whether it was the ease with which he thought he could repeal Obamacare in his first term, his response to COVID saying it would end by Easter, You know, the complexity of ending the war in Ukraine, the complexity of immigration policy and bringing sound immigration policy to the U.S. So, again, he has serially underrated the complexity of these situations. And I think that those of us who are skeptical about his proclamation could be forgiven, given that history.
JP.
Yeah, I was, you know, as you read and listen to Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer praise the president and his leadership, you kind of have to rub your eyes and make sure that you read it and heard it correctly. It's kind of unbelievable that, you know, there's bipartisan praise for the president on this huge victory for him and certainly for the people of Israel and the also the people of Palestine. I was very happy for the 20 living hostages that got back to their families and the 1,700 Palestinian captured folks that were also returned. I agree a lot with what Mayor Sheehan said in that, you know, when Trump says it's a new Middle East, if you look at it from a global perspective, are the relations between Israel and the people of Palestine better or worse than they were 2 years ago on October 7th before the attack happened? It's obviously a much more dangerous place than it was 2 years ago. It's a much worse situation both for Israelis and for Palestinians. And you know what? If someone thinks that there's not going to be another terrorist attack from Hamas or another, you know, overwrought response from Israel, I would argue that there will be. It's a question of when, not if. I think that if you look at what Hamas, I think, was trying to achieve on October 7th with their terrorist attack where they slaughtered, I think, over 1,000 innocent people, part of their big objective was to diminish support for Israel in the United States. And Hamas, in my view, achieved their objective in that you have seen United States public support, both from Democrats and Republicans, has significantly diminished since the war started. And from that standpoint, I think Hamas partially achieved one of their objectives.
Mike?
Yeah, often people have compared the way Trump approaches these things, you know, Ukraine, Obamacare, whatever. He is like the developer that comes in and goes for the big announcement that we have a big plan, it's great, and there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. In this case, I hope he's right, but usually you guys go work out the details, and that's kind of the way it sounds. It's, you know, it is wonderful that the killing has stopped, although the BBC reported just a little while ago there's been some violence along the line where the Israeli soldiers are and Palestinians are. But the reality is a lot has to be worked out. It was a 20-point peace plan to which Hamas and Israel had not agreed to all of them. And we don't know if Hamas is going to put down its arms. We don't know if Hamas will accept not being part of the civilian oversight and want to be a part of that. And who is going to emerge as the leadership, the government in Palestine right now? And it, certainly, while President Trump was declaring, and I hope he's correct, that this is a great day of peace and that it will change the whole Middle East, Bibi Netanyahu was standing right there. He hasn't acknowledged that this is over, and it's more like a ceasefire. He hasn't, by any means, and certainly is opposed to any kind of independence for Palestine. And neither Hamas or Israel were in Egypt when these 20 or so countries were signing a peace agreement, which really is only a document saying we want peace. It doesn't have any details. So, yes, we can be forgiven for being skeptical, Mayor Sheehan. You're right. And hoping that the people to which Trump and others delegate to work out the details are skilled and successful. ordinarily in diplomacy, a lot of that's worked out before the big announcement. This is in reverse. The big announcement happened, and good things happened because of it, and we applaud that. But a lot of details, and gosh, it's a lot of hurdles to overcome.
And I think that, you know, you said that, you know, the killing has stopped, the violence has stopped, but, you know, that's still very tenuous. But I also think that for the Palestinians, the deaths have not stopped. The humanitarian crisis created by Netanyahu's war and the devastating impact that has had, I think, calls for a real sense of urgency from nations around the world to come to the aid of the Palestinians in Gaza. And I don't think that we have the slightest sliver of understanding of, well, I guess we do have an understanding of what that's going to take. We've seen devastation post-World War II. We've seen it, but this is on a massive scale that is going to require for the world to step up and for Israel to step up and bring aid as quickly as possible. Because there are people who are still dying because they don't have access to the medical care that they need. They don't have the nutritional needs met. So I think that response is what the world is going to be watching.
Yeah, and I agree. And I also think that we are in a new phase in that without Hamas holding innocent people as captives, a lot of the justification of what Netanyahu and the Israeli government, that justification now is gone.
So, I mean, we talked about this, but looking at this article in the New York Times, getting Israel's hostages released from Gaza and stopping the war may have taken 2 years in the direct efforts of the American president and the leaders of several Arab and Muslim nations. But that was almost certainly the easy part, getting Hamas to give up its weapons and demilitarizing the Gaza Strip. Key preconditions for Israel to pull out of Gaza fully, as both President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reiterated on Monday, could prove a lot harder. Then there are the other issues in Mr. Trump's 20-point plan. Mike was pointing to this earlier, which outlined a comprehensive solution for Gaza. In full, it also called for the establishment of an international force to help maintain security in the territory, an ambitious effort to rebuild Gaza's economy and infrastructure, and the creation of a temporary Palestinian governing committee whose work would be overseen by an international board. During the talks leading up to the ceasefire in Gaza, provisions for who would run the enclave on the day after the war was over were among the most complicated and vexing, so much so that they were eventually severed from the ceasefire talks and put off until a second phase of negotiations. And that's really what I wanted to talk for a moment about, of exactly how you think the second part of those negotiations are going to go, because this is where the real issues are going to have to be discussed.
Well, JP just mentioned that Israel no longer has an issue that they used to justify their attacks on Gaza. I don't know that they were justified, but that was at least a legitimate issue of, getting back the hostages that they were fighting for. And with that off the table, and with Hamas having 1,700 Palestinian detainees, as they're called, returned home, it does take away some of the, at least premises for the violence. But, all you have to do is see those aerial shots over Gaza, and it's just rubble. There's no sewer system. There's no water system. There's no hospitals. There's no streets. You can't even drive on the streets. People are going back to their homes and saying, I can't even find what street it was on. It is so destroyed. I mean, there is just so much to do, and it's going to take so much effort. And that wasn't any part of the discussion yesterday, and that has to be front and center.
But go ahead, Jamie.
Well, yes, and on the hostages, I agree. You know that the hostages were such leverage for Hamas. You know, now they really don't have leverage. I guess that there are dead bodies that they may have, or that may be buried under the rubble, but the fact that they don't have the leverage of having the hostages, and Israel doesn't have the justification of Hamas having the hostages. It brings us into a dramatically new phase of this conflict, which has lasted for, 1,000 years. Joe mentioned earlier, you know, Hamas demilitarizing or giving up their arms, you know, that's never going to happen. That's like asking Cookie Monster to give up his cookies. You know, they're going to have weaponry, and that's how they identify themselves. They're a terrorist organization. So, yes, yesterday was a great day, great pictures. It was great to see people get home to their families. And I, for one, I never thought it would happen. I thought they're never going to give up the hostages, because the day that they give up all the hostages, the people that were negotiating for Hamas are going to get obliterated by Israel. I'm surprised Israel has not yet, you know, taken out the hostage negotiators. But It will be interesting to watch in the coming days, for sure.
Yeah, when I visited Israel with a group of mayors in 2019, we spoke with a person who had been involved in peace negotiations, several attempts at peace negotiations over the years, a two-state solution, all of the various iterations. And one of the things that he said was something to the effect of, there's no definition of justice for one side that is not seen as an injustice by the other. This is a really very, very complex, I don't want to use the word intractable, because it presumes that we can't push through it, but these attempts at finding a way towards peace have been attempted. And again, it's where I think the president just really underrates how complex the situation is. And we all have to hold out hope that maybe something shifted in the horror of what we've seen over the last 2 years on both sides that will allow those who truly want peace to be given a voice and to prevail. And that is a hope that we always have to have.
That was Kathy Sheehan on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, October 14th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, October 15th, Joe was joined by Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead Anna Markowitz, Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, Alexander Mihailovich, and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio.
President Donald Trump said Tuesday that the United States could step in to disarm Hamas quickly and perhaps violently, quote unquote, if the organization did not do it itself. A potential vulnerability in a U.S.-brokered ceasefire agreement that has tentatively brought an end to 2 years of war between Israel and Hamas. This from reporting from The Washington Post by Amy Wang and Sammy Westfall. Hamas, which has controlled Gaza for nearly two decades, has not yet publicly agreed to or signed anything that specifies how it will disarm, though Trump suggested Tuesday that he has received verbal assurances that the group would. Everyone says, oh, well, they won't disarm. They will disarm, Trump said Tuesday at a White House event. And I spoke to Hamas and I said, you're going to disarm, right? Yes, sir, we're going to disarm. That's what they told me. They will disarm or we will disarm them. Got it? Okay. So Trump declined to provide specifics on how the United States would do that. And when asked about a deadline, said that it would be a reasonable period of time. What is a reasonable period of time, Alex?
Well, that's a good question because, in fact, the hostages, the 20 remaining hostages, will be officially released on Monday. So this is a kind of an in-between period, you know, where the agreement, technically speaking, has not taken effect. And one of the consequences of this is that Hamas is essentially freely using the weapons it has to what they see as a form of disciplining of the Gazan population, the people whom they consider to be traitors among the Palestinians in the territory. Many of them are getting arrested or executed. So this is all kind of bluster, it seems to me, because in fact this period of this kind of pause, in the 20-point security plan taking effect, is resulting in the short term in considerable acts of localized violence. Yes, the Israeli Defense Force incursion within the territory has stopped. However, one paradoxical effect of all of this is that Hamas has been put into the position of being the official voice of the Gazan population, not the Palestinian Authority. And so we can talk about the different ways in which the Palestinian Authority over an extended period of time has kind of lost its street cred. It hasn't had much respect among the Palestinians in general and the Palestinian Gazans in particular. However, I'm a little bit concerned about the ways in which Gaza is becoming empowered, almost in an official capacity. Essentially, what is happening is that Israel is recognizing Hamas as the voice of the Palestinians within Gaza. And I'm not sure that's necessarily a good development.
So let me ask before I want to hear from everyone, but when we've been talking just over the last 24, 48 hours about there's the agreement and then there's all this other stuff that needs to be worked out that is really the big keys to the deal. This is part of what we're talking about, right?
It is.
Yeah,
it is. And, the 20-point peace plan is very interesting. I mean, one of the things that it leaves open is the possibility of the establishment of a dual-state solution. But, and in many respects, the 20-point peace plan is what Biden had in place as well. The details are not terribly different. What has changed are the conditions on the ground and globally. Very specifically, the Trump administration and other countries have choked off the support of Iran, of Hamas, but also the Qataris, mm-hmm. who are now firmly on Trump's side, even though in many respects Qatar, pursues officially at least, an Islamist, policy. But now they have established a kind of, really a sort of a financial arrangement with Qatar where they're going to, Haig Seth has spoken about establishing a Qatari-run military base in Utah, I think, or Oklahoma. I can't remember which. There's talk of this kind of amped up, economic relations between Qatar and the United States, which has motivated Qatar to sort of stop the flow of military support to Hamas, right? So that's what's changed. And I'm not taking anything away from you know, from Trump and his negotiating team. But let me just say that much of what we're seeing in that plan is essentially an extension of what, you know, of previous administrations or the previous administration, with, you know, objective circumstances globally having changed, which is what affected this, you know, this turnaround.
Robert.
Well, I both love and dislike being on the roundtable with Alex and discussing foreign affairs because he is a genuine expert and I'm just, you know, some guy who reads the papers. So I mostly agree with what you're saying, with one or two, you know, mild caveats. One, I mean, I think that the plan, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but to my mind, it's what's the difference between now and a year or so ago? Well, the difference is the Trump administration's use of physical force and as you say, the facts on the ground. You know, no attack on Iran, no attack on Qatar, no deal.
Right.
So I think that's that kinetic reality, as it were, I think has brought these parties to the table. In terms of, you know, Trump's you know, typical inarticulate posturing about disarming Hamas, well, I think the permission structure now exists for him to say things like that and mean it, because they have both Israel and the U.S. have demonstrated time and again that they're less concerned with diplomatic niceties than imposing their will. So, and, you know, vis-a-vis the 20-point plan, well, the most salient point, right, Alex, is the troops have withdrawn and the hostages, the living hostages at least, are home.
Yeah.
So what leverage does Hamas have? And by the way, as soon as I say the word leverage, it's an echo of that, to my mind, kind of irresponsible thing the New York Times did earlier this week where they referred to those living hostages as Hamas's, quote, leverage, which struck me as inelegant, to put it nicely. Mm-hmm. But back to where we are right now, the living hostages are home.
Yeah.
The shooting has ended. Mm-hmm. If Trump is saying we will disarm them, I assume that he means it, and it has to be taken seriously.
No, I don't.
We're not disagreeing. I'm
we're
just
not. We're not really disagreeing. You're simply, you know, elaborating on these facts, you know, at the grassroots level, which I think are important to bear in mind. Here's the difficulty. It seems to me, by recognizing Hamas as the representative for the region.
De facto,
officially, but de facto, presenting it in that position. One consequence of this is that if they are in fact kind of the administration of the of Gaza, you allow, or it's kind of you're opening up the fire door for them to have an internal security force, like,
but
essentially.
How is that different? And I'm asking this in earnest. It's not a challenge. I just don't know. How is that different than the last 20 years when Hamas has been functionally the political leadership of Gaza?
It's not different. That's I guess that's largely the point that I'm trying to make.
They haven't been removed from.
They haven't been removed from power. You know, so, you know, they, you know, in you know, as a kind of, you know, as, how can I put it, as a political power that has its own army that can act, you know, in this sort of, you know, in a way, in vis-a-vis other countries in the region, you know, that has been, so it seems, detoothed. But what has not been taken away is this kind of regional authority, internal authority for Gaza itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're allowing them essentially, or recognizing them as the primary spokesperson, or, you know, entity, you know, for, you know, the population of that area. And there are all sorts of problems that have to be addressed. It's not just a matter of, you know, of Hamas as a military organization. Mm-hmm. 80% to 90% of the structures, architectural structures in the area have been destroyed, you know. The single most among Palestinians living in Gaza right now, the single most needed resource is not food, but cleaning supplies, you know. And so, you know, reconstruction has to take place, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very, you know, nervous about the idea of, you know, of Hamas, you know. I don't think it's even equipped to deal with a project like that.
Yeah.
You know? So that's my main concern.
Well, if Israel's war aim was the and I don't know how they phrased it at the time, the elimination, the destruction of Hamas, then what you're suggesting is that goal, even if the fighting is over, even if they are disarmed, as a political matter, that goal has not been met.
Not fully.
Okay.
I would put it this way, you know. So anyway.
Yeah. Anna.
I mean, I think you make a really interesting point about Hamas there. It is my understanding that they are going to be receiving amnesty if they turn in their guns. And so I'm hoping that that means that while they'll be, you know, protected from, you know, execution or things of that level, that hopefully they'll be removed and there'll be some sort of rebuilding and change of leadership there. But I think that there's a lot that could go wrong in this. I think that Netanyahu hasn't verbally said that this is, in fact, the end of the war. I think that when Trump went to Egypt and had a meeting with many different leaders to try to hash out the details, there weren't a lot of concrete outcomes that came from that about, like, how is this actually going to happen? Is there going to be a two-state solution? Who's going to lead Gaza and Palestine? Like, so, you know, I think that it's great that the hostages are returned, and this is a great step, but I think that we still need to see if this is going to stick or if this is going to unravel and just go back to war again.
Yeah, and another element of all this, of course, is internal Israeli politics. You know, I have a little bit of a bee in my bonnet when anybody says anti-Israel, not because I don't think it has anything to do bears no relation to anti-Semitism, but because it's very imprecise. I mean, Israel is a parliamentary democracy. Like many democracies, it is highly imperfect. However, you can't talk about it as a single bolus. It is not a single entity. It is not a person. All right. The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, has many different parties, you know, all the way from the far, far right to the far, far left. All right. One of the most leftist parties in the Israeli parliament, the Hadash party, is, you know, not only are they very critical vis-a-vis Netanyahu and the Likud party, they're very critical of the entire military campaign in Gaza, which they consider one of their leaders, Ofer Kassab, has called it a genocide, right? And, you know, there's all this talk about, you know, applying that term, and I'm not even going to, you know, I'm not addressing the whole question of how valid that term is. I'm just talking about the kinds of discussions that you're hearing in Israel, so many of which are kind of teasing through these ideas, you know. And there are many people within political power, within many of the parties, who do consider this as being a kind of a human rights outrage, the way it was done. Right. Not necessarily that it was done.
Alex, I was interested when you were talking earlier at the beginning of your remarks, you mentioned sort of the timeline and what we're looking at as far as the next release of more hostages. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so what do you see the timeline over the next week or two of how that's going to unfold?
Well, I think that one is hesitant to make sort of concrete predictions, but I think that the hostages will be released because, you know, Hamas doesn't have that many, you know, good cards in its hand right now. I think that's what is more murky is the political solution to, you know, all of this. One other wild card is, you know, the whole question of human rights violations in Gaza. I don't care for the term genocide that people have used in regard, you know, to the last 2 years in Gaza. I think that it doesn't fit the situation. However, I think that there is definitely an element, at the very least, of ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is not, you know, it's not physical extermination. It's simply the physical removal or expulsion or harassment of local populations. And the precedent here that's very clear is that the war of the 90s in the Balkans, what was occurring in parts of Serbia, well, more specifically Bosnia and some limited areas in Croatia. And the whole question is now the Gazans who are returning, first of all, how many of them will return? That's one question. It seems that only a fraction, because people have settled elsewhere, essentially. And the other thing is, which I alluded to, the factor is that's very important, is the paucity of physical resources in Gaza right now. You know, cleaning supplies, food. You know, already, you know, the corridor for food and other forms of aid in Rafah, the border with Egypt, has been is still essentially closed. So it's not clear if there's going to be enough of that available for the returning population, and more people will return, obviously, only if that's you know, if there's a prospect for that coming about, because they're not going to go back to a situation where they're, you know, essentially don't have enough to live on.
Well, again, Alex, you're the expert. But I can't shake the feeling that things are just as different and unexpected in the Middle East as they've been in my lifetime. And yeah, we're, you know, roughly the same age. We're both in our 60s. And I attribute that to this administration, whether you like Donald Trump or not, its willingness to both use and authorize force. In other words, you know, the niceties of diplomacy have been set aside, and the obvious posture is force and the willingness to use it. So I'm not blithe about the humanitarian aspects of this, but it just feels to me like you almost have to throw out the playbook at this point. Things are just different.
Right. I agree in part with what you're saying. Just a qualifier here. It seems to me that there is an element of diplomacy, but it's not traditional diplomacy.
There you go. Well said.
You know, I mean, in regard to Qatar, you know, because I find that very interesting, because you know, this was, you know, a form of kind of, you know, mutual ego massaging, you know? And but also, you know, financial incentive. And I mean, look, you know, another element.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. Isn't that where things changed with that strike on Qatar? And sure, you know, reportedly Trump called Bibi on the carpet over it.
Right.
But once Israel said, look, if you're in Hamas, or if you're sheltering Hamas, you are not safe. You can no longer rely on this distant, removed from the battlefield.
Right.
We're going to find you. We're going to get you.
Right.
To me, that was the moment where everything changed.
That was Robert Pondicio on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, October 15th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, October 16th, Joe was joined by Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, an investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
We begin with covert CIA action in Venezuela. And this is the Trump administration authorizing covert CIA action in Venezuela. The development comes as the U.S. military is drawing up options for President Trump to consider including possible strikes inside the country. The administration has secretly authorized the CIA to conduct covert action in Venezuela, according to U.S. officials, stepping up a campaign against the country's authoritarian leader, Maduro. The authorization is the latest step in the Trump administration's intensifying pressure campaign against Venezuela. For weeks, the U.S. military has been targeting boats off the coast. It says are transporting drugs, killing 27 people. American officials have been clear privately that the end goal is to drive Mr. Maduro from power. Mr. Trump acknowledged on Wednesday that he had authorized the covert action and said the United States was considering strikes on Venezuelan territory. Mark Whitman.
Well, Joe, this is like watching a magician set fire to the curtain he's supposed to hide behind, right? I'm when he public when our president publicly says he's authorized covert action, except this time the blaze actually may be part of the act, right? Trump built his campaign fighting migration and to some extent illegal drugs, and he may not want to linger too much on topics of stolen elections or dictator's abuse, but now he's not so secretly authorized the CIA to conduct operations inside of Venezuela, potentially even threatening Maduro. Maduro's a horrible guy, right? I mean, this once bus driver has jailed, tortured, and killed his opponents. He's rigged elections, and he's left his country starving while he and the elite steal from PDVSA, the country's oil firm, and launder money. I mean, the nation's curse in Venezuela, as it is in so many of these corrupt petrostate, is that it's barrels of crude fueling ruin. And it's caused an incredible migration, which is a problem in the area. As well, Maduro has harbored insurrectionists or terrorists from countries who are operating in neighboring countries like Colombia. But Trump insists this is about drugs and border security, but the subtext really is oil. And Trump earlier this year allowed Chevron waivers on all the prohibitions against doing business with Venezuela, and they're now back in Venezuela. And many people believe that's to get a pole position for what might happen on the other side of any disruption of the current government. Additionally, you know, our alleged Secretary of State Rubio, whose family fled Castro's Cuba, has helped shape this plan. His crusade is both sort of personal and historical. Yet, if you think about what the CIA has done in Latin America, I mean, it's less like James Bond, right? And it's more like the Keystone Cops with incredible moral and costs to the populace. And by the way, in Latin America and everywhere else I can think of where the CIA has been operating. And so that brings me to my main worry, which is what I call the seatback card problem. You know, when you're on an airline and you're supposed to read the seatback safety card, the one thing it tells you is that when you're jumping out of the plane, you're supposed to look outside the exit and make sure it's not worse where you're going. And the CIA seems to never do that when it topples these governments. Now we have 10,000 U.S. troops and warships in the Caribbean. The curtain's burning. And, you know, Trump and his crew are improvising. And I fear the horror show has only begun there.
Fran.
Yeah, this is interesting. So when I think about this, I have two kinds of questions. The first question is, are we using a different playbook than, you know, presidents for many years and many different kinds of administrations have used with the CIA and covert action? And I really am curious as to whether Trump is doing something different at all. I mean, it does seem like, you know, taking out Venezuelan boats that are ostensibly drug trafficking, you know, maybe that's a slightly different playbook, but the rest of it seems similar to me. And that brings me back to a question that's not especially connected to Trump, which is, what should the U.S. be doing in other countries to intervene to maintain whatever style of life the administration would like to maintain? In the past, I thought of that as a democratic style of life. I'm not sure I think that anymore personally. I mean, is just this really essentially the same playbook we've always played by with a different set of people. And so I, not being a political scientist myself, you know, I'd be really interested in our listeners writing in to provide some input on that, because I think those are really fundamental questions about this.
Bill? I thought it was kind of odd to refer to what was going on here as covert operations and secret plans when it's now completely public and the president made it public. Like it,
yes.
And I wondered if is the CIA really doing anything there, or is he just getting into Maduro's head by saying that that's going to happen? I mean, I feel like that in and of itself can backfire, because now Maduro can say, you know, he can arrest somebody and say, well, I'm arresting this person because they are part of a CIA plot. And it won't sound like a crazy conspiracy theory, because the president has said there is a CIA plot. So I guess the other... okay, so one thing I wondered when I was reading about this development is, I wonder what the Nobel Peace Prize winner thinks, Maria Machado. She's the opposition, or a dissident in Venezuela. She has to live in hiding because she's afraid of what would happen if she was arrested. And she is cheering this on. She thinks this is great. She wants President Trump to take out Maduro. And I just, that sort of really twists my mind in knots, because, you know, she's a Peace Prize winner, she's a dissident, and she's welcoming a very hostile act by the United States. She also said nice things about President Trump, said he absolutely deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. So I certainly did not expect that reaction from her, and it raises all kind of questions in my mind. I guess a final point I would make is that the president is justifying some of his use of the military and some of his, you know, use of the military to enforce immigration laws. I believe he cited the threat of Tren de Agua. He sort of said, we're at war with Tren de Agua, therefore I can nationalize the National Guard. That triggers my power to... Well, if he... His argument is Maduro is controlling Tren de Agua. If he actually starts a war, if the U.S. is in some kind of quasi-military action involving Venezuela, that strengthens his argument that Tren de Agua is a foreign military presence in the U.S., and therefore I can nationalize the National Guard. I don't know if that's crossed his mind in all of this, but like the whole thing is very puzzling. Why he would be picking this fight at this time, other than maybe he has this kind of reflexive ability to draw attention to himself and change the subject constantly.
And then there is the issue of Maduro and trying to
he's like a very bad guy, but like why? At this moment in U.S. history, is it our job to get rid of a bad guy? I don't understand that.
All right. Let's move on to other subjects this morning. 17 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We go to this story about a judge ordering the president and the administration to pause shutdown layoffs. Unions have sued to block dismissals during the government shutdown. A federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration's plans to lay off thousands of federal workers during this shutdown, siding with unions, which have argued that the dismissals were illegal. Senior U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston said Wednesday that the administration must halt its layoffs less than a week after eight agencies, Commerce, Education, Energy, Environmental Protection, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Homeland Security, and Treasury, had issued reduction in force notices to more than 4,100 workers. About half of the firings at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were later reversed, but administration officials and President Donald Trump have promised further cuts, blaming Democrats for not agreeing to pass legislation to fund the government. Mark.
Joe, this brought up a broader topic for me, and I heard somebody, I'll have to give credit to an author I've forgotten who in one opinion piece, you know, talked about the fact that effectively, if you imagine that the founders had written our Constitution in a way to try and anticipate every eventuality and handed us a set of volumes as thick as an encyclopedia, they still would have failed to predict every turn and twist in a country. What we're supposed to rely on are unwritten norms and a shared reverence for how our democratic republic should function. And that's the problem now we're facing. The Trump administration is happy to shred these norms and values, and the pliant Republicans just respond by saying, well, you never wrote a law against this, right? I mean, we assume certain things. We assume that if there was a Supreme Court vacancy, that it should get filled promptly. Mitch McConnell taught us otherwise. I was crazy. I thought that if somebody was elected to the House of Representatives, that as soon as practically possible, they should be sworn in and seat us. But Johnson now has convinced me that that's not really what the founders meant necessarily. And I also thought that a president wasn't supposed to treat his personal power like a vendetta or a wrecking ball that he could use against his political opponents. And now we're watching, unfortunately, the courts try to hold the line because that's all we've got left at this point. You know, slowly at the lower levels, the courts seem to all too slowly be getting there roughly in the right way. And I think this decision around Trump trying to use firings during a shutdown as a vendetta, I think the court basically got it right. But our real fear, right, is that Supreme Court, which hasn't shown much interest in defending the norms that our founders so firmly believed in. You know, the irony is we're relying now on a judicial branch and eventually very specifically the Supreme Court to remember that our democracy was never about the letter of the law. It's always been about shared values. And unfortunately, we're asking the people who now sit on the Supreme Court to take that view. And I don't think everybody's assured that they will.
So I think in this case, actually, there is a law. There's a law that says you can't do reductions in force during a shutdown, isn't there? I mean, that's the basis for the court decision, I believe. And so the ironic thing is that as soon as the shutdown is over, some of what the president's trying to do with these reductions in force would stop being illegal. Like once the government is, you know, fully funded and operational. So, but the part of it that is norm violating is targeting agencies based on politics rather than, you know, the proper operation of government. But this, it's a very arcane area of law. Like the idea that you're, when the government doesn't have money, you're not allowed to lay people off. That's like a counterintuitive in some ways. But that does seem to be the law, and it also seems to be the basis for the court decision.
Fran.
Yeah, this is, I agree with a lot of what we've been saying. It's kind of a rinse-repeat moment. And it's a little mind-boggling. There are ways we've always done things, some which adhere to principles but have broader legal support, some of which don't have legal support, some of which do. And, you know, all of those things are sort of out the window. And we have a leader who is very vindictive. We have a leader who is very short-sighted. We have a leader who, and all of these, in my opinion, really isn't very interested in the public interest, you know, is interested in being first and profitability and, you know, feathering their own nest. And so this is sort of still another thing where a shutdown, which is a serious thing, and by the way, a solvable problem. There's lots of different ways we could look at budgeting in this country and continuation of public services, both under, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations that we just don't do. But, you know, this is a situation where this is going to be tough on everyone. And purposefully, now it's tough on more people than others. And which people? People who don't agree with the leadership in power. People who have ostensibly done something bad to the leadership in power. And I think what was said was exactly right, is that now we have to rely on law, which can never figure out all possible situations. I mean, the founders had no ideas what a smartphone was, right? And now we have to think about privacy in that world and security in that world and all kinds of crazy things in that world. And so, you know, now we have laws that kind of have to hold up. And there's a whole body of practice and intention and protocol and ritual around all of those. And those are getting supported or ignored, you know, based on what to me often seems like a whim, a self-serving whim. And so, yeah, I mean, this is a rinse-repeat moment. Is there something new here in terms of, you know, abuse of power? Maybe not. You know, is it going to affect more people? Probably. What can be done about it? Well, you know, I agree. I think the courts have been, you know, often heroic in this time to try to kind of stand up for that. You know, this is why I'd rather really talk about traffic, to tell you the truth. But, you know, it's just a tough time to live in. It feels apocalyptic to me. It feels dangerous to me. It feels unfair to me. And I bet there's a lot of people out there, you know, who have similar feelings. And there are a lot of people who are overjoyed with this. So I don't think we should forget about this. And I don't think we should assume they're all bad people, or they haven't all sort of thought about their responses in ways that make sense to them. So to me, that's the mystery of this time, that there is such strong feelings on kind of both sides of these issues. And very little real communication.
That communication is an interesting aspect, because so many of these decisions that are coming out, and I understand why, but so many of these decisions that are coming out are, you can't do this for now. You can't do this for now. We're halting this temporarily. And it's, in other words, there's no actual, it's a decision.
There's no plan.
Yeah, it's a decision that says we're going to make another decision later.
Well, so there's a huge disconnect between the pace at which the Trump administration is moving and the pace at which the courts digest legal issues.
Correct.
He has been a fire hose of legal issues. He's exercising executive power in ways that have never been exercised before. He's asserting executive power. He's ignoring norms, but also arguably violating laws. But he's doing it at such a pace that, you know, somebody has to file a suit, then it has to go to the court, and the judge has to digest it, and they have to write up their opinion, and then it has to get appealed up the chain. All of that takes months. And by the time it's gotten to the third or fourth month, the Trump administration has done 100 other things that are going to launch lawsuits. This is kind of a gripe of mine. I think our court system needs to move faster, but I don't think there's any court system in the world that could move as fast as the Trump administration has done. And so you've got this backlog of decisions that have been decided on, like there's been a temporary stay or an injunction or a whatever. You know, it might be 2035 before we've got final decisions on a lot of these cases. And, you know, in the meantime, the norms have been violated and the facts on the ground are what the president wants them to be for the time being.
That was Bill Hammond on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, October 16th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.